Maybe you're still having a hard time wrapping your mind around the Big Bang. It can be a little hard to envision a vast universe where even light takes billions of years to travel, beginning from a single point and an explosion. But that's what science shows as the birth of our universe. And science is not only trying to work out the details of what happened at the Big Bang long ago, it's considering recreating the event on a small scale. Could it happen in a laboratory? Well, that's what Zia Murali explores in her book, A Big Bang in a Little Room, The Quest to Create New Universes. Zia Murali is a science journalist with a strong background of her own, a PhD in theoretical physics and cosmology. Zia's work has appeared in Scientific American and Discover and similar publications. She's also the author of two textbooks in conjunction with National Geographic. Zia Murali, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
I notice you also edit the website for the Foundational Questions Institute, which sounds fascinating. What is that?
Well, it's exactly what it says on the tin. It looks into foundational questions about the origins of the universe, about, you know, the nature of reality, the nature of time, the multiverse, the universe, whether there are parallel universes. It's a funding agency that funds researchers and scientists looking into all of these big questions about where we all came from.
And it goes beyond the physical, it sounds like, into the metaphysical.
Yes, exactly. One of the issues, one of the reasons the Foundational Questions Institute was set up was because so many people get into physics because they're, you know, excited about these very deep questions that are just at the boundaries of metaphysics, but often there isn't very much money from the government or, you know, around the world to fund these pieces of research. And so the Foundational Questions Institute was set up to kind of try and fill that gap and deal with some of these really important issues that I think lots of people really care about.
You know, when you mention it, it does seem like science money is easier to come by from governments if it involves things like dealing with health issues or how to build better weapons and things like that. For the more theoretical things, is it just that much harder to latch onto funding?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And it's, of course, understandable, I think, that, you know, governments want to put money into things that are going to have applications for people's day-to-day lives, for things like healthcare, the environment, the climate, energy. You know, these are all important things that the government should be putting money into. So this is something that's kind of set up with private funding. It's a charitable institute. And it has a little bit more freedom to let people think about these other questions at the same time as thinking about science that can give you all of those applications to everyday life, but also, you know, giving people a chance to take a step back, take a deep breath, and look into some of these bigger questions too.
So the area you're talking about in your book, A Big Bang in a Little Room, how long has science been talking about this, and how close are we to actually achieving this?
It's been kicking around for about 30 to 40 years. It's something that came about by accident. It wasn't as though physicists sat down and thought, oh, you know what we'd like to do today? We'd like to make our own universe in the laboratory. Actually, what happened was that they were just trying to understand more about where our universe comes from. And they were trying to think about what happened in the early universe and how it was that, you know, a very tiny amount of space kind of exploded and inflated really, really quickly, really rapidly to create the huge cosmos that we live in today. And while they were trying to think about how that process occurred in the very early universe, they started to realize that maybe the same process could happen again within our universe by taking a tiny little piece of space and inflating it to create a universe in a laboratory.
Which then gets you to laying a heavy thought upon us at the outset, which is that if we can do it, what does that say about our universe?
Oh, yeah, you know, it's the first question that came to my mind, as you say, when I was writing the book. You know, if we're really seriously sitting down and thinking about this, and, you know, we're only just sort of at the early stages of having built particle accelerators, which can create new particles, which is a sort of experimental environment in which this could happen, then, you know, was our universe created in somebody else's lab? And I spoke to physicists who've been looking into that question and who've sort of been thinking about the possibility that not only could our universe have been created in somebody else's laboratory, the laboratory of a very advanced alien civilization, but perhaps they might even have kind of engraved a little message into the sky that we could look at. perhaps potentially one day even find, and, you know, find evidence that our universe was created by, you know, an outside intelligence.
That communication from the beginning, that hidden communication from the start of the universe, what is that about? I mean, you could get into that in the book and describe it at times as a cosmic selfie.
Yes, right. So this is something, the cosmic selfie is actually something that astronomers are well aware of. They found that in itself is not really a message from an outside creator, but it is evidence that our universe started in a Big Bang. So when the Big Bang theory was first put about in the 1960s, soon afterwards, people realized that if our universe had started from this very, very tiny speck of space and time that exploded outwards, that explosion would actually leave behind radiation that we could still detect today. And it's all around us. It's just very, very kind of, it's very low temperature radiation. We don't usually notice it. If you had an old-fashioned kind of television set, one of these analog television sets, if you remember them, when you changed the channel, sometimes if you were in between channels, you'd see this kind of white snow on the television screen, this kind of buzzing. And, you know, some certain percentage of that buzzing was actually this radiation that was left over from the Big Bang.
Wow.
And it comes from, when our infant universe was about 300 to 400,000 years old. And it's when light kind of first appeared in the universe, and it takes a snapshot of the universe in its early stages.
All right, we'll pick that up on the other side of it.
Cosmic selfie.
All right, back shortly with Zia Morali. Her book is A Big Bang in the Little Room. We'll return to the exchange in 1 minute. You're back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. I appreciate you listening. We're talking to Zia Morali, who is the holder of a PhD in theoretical physics and cosmology in her own right, and has used that to become a science journalist, and has written some fascinating works, including A Big Bang in a Little Room, her new book about the quest to create new universes, as in, could we make a new Big Bang in a laboratory? And if so, well, there are a lot of questions. You probably have them. Join us with those questions on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Send them in by email to jx@jeffnet.org. Zia, I appreciate your visits with scientists in here. It seems like you have a lot of fun with them. You visited with Anthony Zee at the University of California, Santa Barbara. What's his role in all of this?
Right. So he's one of these, one of the physicists who's been looking into this question of whether our universe was created in somebody else's laboratory. And so he'd sort of been thinking about whether or not we could find evidence of that in the night sky. And he and his colleague, Stephen Hsu, actually carried out an analysis where they suggested that actually if our universe was created in someone else's laboratory, they might have left patterns in the kind of radiation that pervades our universe that astronomers have already detected. Maybe there might be some hidden code written into that light, that radiation that astronomers have already found, that's kind of, a kind of trademark of the people that, or the advanced civilization that might have made our universe.
So essentially you asked a physicist if he theorizes about God?
I asked, I asked him about that. I asked pretty much everybody that I spoke to in the book because, this issue does... it does raise questions about where our universe came from and whether or not there's a need for a God and whether or not, these physicists believe in God or whether their work changed their beliefs. So one thing, our universe could have been made by an alien intelligence. It could have been made by God. When we're talking in terms of these messages that could have been left on the radiation. And, that's something that they were looking for. Each of these physicists that I spoke to, they had different personal feelings about this. Some of them believed in God, some of them don't. Some of them are just curious whether or not they believe in God, just to see if there is any sign of one out there, or whether or not, if you found out that our universe was created by superior intelligence, would that be what we thought of as God? Or would that be another, an alien civilization just like ours who happened to make a lab in their garage?
So I want to come to the Big Bang itself and get into some of the specifics of what happened there and why it helps to understand that, to understand what we understand. Oh, boy, here we go. Understanding our understandings. To be able to recreate events, potentially. So heat at the Big Bang is very important. Can you explain why it's so important?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. Did you say heat?
Heat, yes. Mm-hmm.
Heat at the Big Bang. Okay, so, you know, in the early universe, the Big Bang, it starts off with the creation of space-time, and also sort of it starts off with this massive explosion, this bang that creates radiation and heat in the early universe that gives rise to the particles, and that's how the particles in the early universe are created. And those particles eventually, they kind of clump together. They create the stars, the galaxies, the planets, the people eventually. So, you know, that's why we talk about the radiation, we talk about the heat in the early universe, and when we want to, or if we want to, I should say, if we wanted to create our own universe, we'd have to put in a lot of energy at the process, at the outset, to try and trigger this process into happening, and potentially to create its own matter, its own space, its own time, its own stars, galaxies, and people within that universe that we created.
So you just said the creation of space-time. So time starts at the Big Bang as well as space?
That's the current thinking, although there are different sorts of ideas about this. So, when we first kind of came up with this idea of the Big Bang, you know, physicists were sort of talking about it. The idea was very much that space and time were created at this point. And before that, you know, you couldn't really ask what happened before the Big Bang. There simply was no time. In recent years, some cosmologists, some physicists have taken the view that, you know, perhaps there isn't just one universe. Ours isn't the only universe out there. Actually, maybe there are neighboring universes to ours, sort of parallel universes. That big bangs could be arising all around us all of the time. In that case, our universe is being born in sort of a wider ocean that we call the multiverse. And in that case, you know, the multiverse existed before our individual little universes came out. So, you know, there it's a slightly different terminology when we talk about the Big Bang happening in many different places. And in that case, there was something that existed before each of those little universes came out, and that was the multiverse.
Okay, and this is where my brain starts to hurt. I'll just remind people we're talking to Zia Morali, who is a science journalist with a PhD in theoretical physics and cosmology. She's written a book called The Big Bang in a Little Room, The Quest to Create New Universes, as in a laboratory. So we got evidence of the Big Bang. We have knowledge of the circumstances. Do we have something close to a complete recipe for recreating?
We have, you know, the beginnings of blueprints, I would say. And what was sort of exciting when I said about writing this book was that, you know, I sort of said that this quest kind of started off about 30 to 40 years ago when scientists first started to get an inkling that maybe they could recreate this process in the lab. Over the intervening decades, different people have kind of come in and sketched in more and more details. By the time you kind of get to this book, we sort of have a blueprint for how you could do it. It needs fleshing out more in the sense that this blueprint kind of says, well, you know, you need some special types of particles. You need a lot of energy. You need equipment that's maybe a little bit more advanced than the equipment we currently have. And you also need some kind of exotic theories of physics. So there are a lot of hypotheticals, there are a lot of ifs, but there's sort of a beginning and an end, and you can sort of say, well, okay, if certain extensions of physics that people believe might be true are true, and if we have equipment that is similar to the equipment we have today but maybe a bit more advanced, and if we manage to get hold of certain particles that people think should exist but haven't yet found, then actually you can put all of these things together. You've got kind of the ingredients, you've got sort of the tools, and you could potentially do this. So we've sort of got a blueprint, but there are gaps.
So you just mentioned, though, the guesses about things, the particles that should exist. So, I mean, do we not anywhere close to the full roster? Do we think we're getting there? Because we're still talking about dark energy, dark matter, things like the Higgs boson, which we weren't sure existed until just a couple of years ago, right?
No, you're absolutely right. But, you know, the wonderful thing is, like you say, you know, we hadn't found the Higgs boson, but the standard model of particle physics told us that there was a really good reason that it should be there. And so, you know, one of the main reasons they built this huge laboratory, you know, underneath Switzerland and France, the Large Hadron Collider, was to find that, to kind of confirm our suspicions. And the particles that I'm talking about, they're called monopoles. And again, there is very good reason that physicists have to believe that the particles are out there somewhere, or that maybe you could make one in a collider, or, you know, you might even find one. People have been looking for them, perhaps falling, you know, from the skies, produced somewhere out in space and falling to Earth. They've been looking for them in moon rock. They've been looking for them in sort of the ocean crust. They have reasons to believe them, but we're not there yet, having found them. But it's, you know, it's exactly like you say. This is very often the case in science. There'll be theories, there'll be things that people, you know, they come up with ideas and they're looking for particles and things that should exist that would help verify their theories. And then the hunt is on to find them.
Playing the gaps until we can figure out what fills those gaps.
Mm-hmm.
Zia Morali is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a science journalist with her own PhD in theoretical physics and cosmology. She's written a book called A Big Bang in a Little Room, The Quest to Create New Universes. It is what it sounds like, science considering, well, could we recreate the Big Bang in a laboratory? And, well, there might be a few ethical and space considerations there. We'll get to those as we talk through this. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Karen in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes, I was wondering if they'd considered the idea of conception, like when the egg is dormant for so long,
mm-hmm.
and then once conception takes place, there's this explosion of activity and reproduction, and the egg,
the
cells start reproducing at this fabulous rate.
So, thinking of the Big Bang as a fertilization, in a sense.
Yes.
All right. Well, let's move on from there. Thanks for that, Karen. Appreciate it. Zia, any thoughts on that?
I think that's a really lovely analogy, and maybe it goes beyond analogy in this particular case, because, you know, when we talk about the Big Bang starting out, you know, you're talking about this tiny, round, little kind of atom. Perhaps it is like an egg, and it goes on, it explodes, it creates potentially life. I mean, it created life in our universe, obviously. You know, potentially we could create life in a laboratory in that respect. So it's, you know, it's a very good comparison to make, I think.
Were the basic principles of physics set by the Big Bang?
Yeah, now this is a very good question. You know, I spoke a little bit earlier about how some cosmologists today think that we might live in a multiverse in which there are many different neighboring universes. And one question they have about that is whether, if there are these parallel universes all around us, whether they have the same laws of physics as our universe. And there's quite good reason to think that if these other universes do exist, that actually they don't have to have the same laws or the same particles, the same forces, even the same number of dimensions. So, you know, we have three spatial dimensions. You know, they don't necessarily have to have the same number. And, you know, in the same vein, if we made our own universe in a laboratory, we might not be able to guarantee what kinds of laws that universe would have.
So a different Big Bang could result in different properties.
Absolutely. Yes.
Okay, so here's where my brain starts to hurt in thinking about the Big Bang, is where did the initial stuff come from? I mean, was there an accumulation? I mean, we're talking something microscopic that went kaboom and created a universe that is billions of miles across, billions of light years across?
Well, there are two different ways to look at that question. So I'll answer it first for making a universe in a laboratory, because this was also something that really confused me as well, that you could potentially create, you know, a massive big universe of astronomical proportions, you know, just in an underground laboratory on Earth. And the answer seemed to be that, yes, that is possible from the calculations that some physicists have made. And, you know, I detail all of this in the book. You could start out with a very tiny particle, a little pinch of space, and fire enough energy onto it that it would just start growing its own space and time. And it's kind of mind-blowing to think of that something so tiny could create, you know, everything, you know, we see around us today. But there's, you know, there's the other side to that question, which is, you know, what happened in our early universe or multiverse? You know, where did that come from? Could that have come out of a very small thing, or did that come out of nothing at all? And one of the people that I speak to in the book actually came up with an analysis where he says that he showed that our universe could have been created out of absolutely nothing. And then you sort of think, well, you know, how?
Where yeah, exactly.
You know, how can something come out of absolutely nothing? But this comes down to one of the laws of microscopic physics that has been well tested in the laboratory today, called quantum physics. It's a very strange theory, but it's, you know, it's a very scientific, very rigorous theory. And it says that sometimes, you know, you can't be sure where things are. Sometimes things can be sort of in more than one place at the same time. Sometimes, you know, things have energy where you would expect them not to have energy. And it's a very strange theory. It's a weird theory. It's a probabilistic theory. It says you can never really be certain where anything is, and you can't be certain that there's ever really nothing there. And it's sort of because of this weird uncertainty that even if you have no time and no space and no matter, if the laws of quantum theory apply, it could be that something spontaneously appears out of nowhere, just because you can't even really be certain that there's nothing, in some sense. And so his calculations kind of showed that you could potentially create a universe out of absolutely nothing.
Zia Murali is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is A Big Bang in a Little Room. I want to make sure that we're keeping the comic books on the shelf. The multiverse that you mentioned, is this different from the multiverse of science fiction where you have like an Earth 1 and an Earth 2 vibrating differently but occupying the same space, just not together?
The multiverse I've been telling you about is kind of different to that, mm-hmm. in the sense that it's a little bit more like it's a little bit more mundane in some ways, a little bit more boring. One, you know, cosmologist described it to me as saying it's not really very much stranger than saying that on this planet we have different countries. It's sort of saying that in the multiverse we have different universes, and they're just neighboring universes, and they can be different. You know, it's just, you know, they're different universes that occupy physical space, but just sort of out of our reach.
Mm-hmm.
But having said that, and you know, I don't want to kind of confuse the issue even further, but in the book I do also talk about the kind of science fiction multiverse that you're sort of picturing there, where there's an alternative me and there's an alternative you, and we're sort of occupying the same kind of space but in different phases or something like that, mm-hmm. and they're, you know, different versions of each of us splitting off into alternate realities. That actually has a good grounding in physics as well. Again, actually, from quantum physics, it's a different kind of multiverse, and that's also something that's discussed in the book. Because, you know, it's something that some physicists believe exists. Not all of them do, but some of them do. And, you know, it's very strange. If you believe that such a thing exists, it can kind of change the way you might choose to live your life. If you think that there are, you know, millions of other versions of you out there, and every act that you carry out, every decision that you make, could kind of split reality and create more versions of yourself. So there's that, too.
Okay.
I'm not sure that helped.
Well, yeah, when it gets to movies like Sliding Doors and stuff like that. All right, I want to clear up, though, that if the universe is expanding, and there's a lot in here about Alan Guth and inflation in the early days of the universe, so things did at one time move faster than light. Is that true?
Yes. The expansion of the universe in an early phase called inflation, which is, you know, put forward by Alan Guth, as you say, he does propose, and there's good reason to believe it did, expand at a rate that was faster than the speed of light. And, you know, I was sort of sitting there talking to him, and I said, hang on a minute. I thought, you know, one thing that we've always been told is that nothing can move faster than the speed of light. So how can it possibly be the case? And he said, well, you know, nothing within the universe can move faster than the speed of light, but there's nothing to stop the universe itself expanding at faster than the speed of light.
Interesting. Okay.
So there you have it.
All right. We'll pick it up on the other side of a break. Zia Morali, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is A Big Bang in a Little Room, The Quest to Create New Universes. Come some questions waiting. We'll get to those in just a few moments. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we return in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the science journalist Zia Morali. We should call her Dr. Morali because she does possess a PhD in theoretical physics and cosmology of her own and has helped the rest of us understand the things that other scientists are doing. Her latest book is called A Big Bang in a Little Room, The Quest to Create New Universes, as in, could we recreate the Big Bang in a laboratory, hopefully small scale. We'll get to those concerns in a moment. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Questions and comments are welcome at 800-838-3760 over the phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Just a general aside here, Zia, it seems like lately in physics that there's a lot of addition going on where each theory seems to build upon the one that went before. Have there been periods in physics, let's say anytime since the beginning of the 20th century, when some theories that people had all bought into were carted away as junk?
Oh, now, I think that's, I'm trying to think of specific examples for you there, but I think that's probably almost always the case in science, and especially in theoretical physics, in the sense that we're in a situation where it's, you know, we're looking at questions about the origins of the universe. We're looking at questions about very, very tiny particles and things like that. These are very difficult ideas to test experimentally. And so we sort of got into a situation with physics where theoretical physics, people's ideas, people's models of the universe have kind of accelerated, but we haven't really had a chance to test them all yet. And so there's kind of a proliferation of wonderful speculative ideas of how our universe might have come into being and what the ultimate theories of reality might be. And we're not yet in a situation where we've been able to test them all yet. And that's partly the case with some of these ideas that go into this book. And so I guess that's, you know, what your concern is, maybe what you're sort of getting at here is, you know, could we turn around and say, well, actually, you know, the theories that are going into this book, the theories that tell us that we could be able to build a universe one day in the laboratory, maybe they might turn out not to be true. You know, what I would say is that the main theory that this whole blueprint for making a universe is based on is called inflation theory. That in itself, at the moment, I would say, is a very well-founded theory. It's the kind of theory that's moved into textbooks. You know, as we're getting more and more observational evidence over the years, it seems to be corroborating that theory. But with science, we're always in a state of knowing that maybe the next experiment, the next observations, will make us rethink our theories and maybe change them, maybe throw some of them out as junk. So, you know, it's a constant state of coming up with ideas, coming up with ways to test ideas, and, you know, making a universe in the laboratory would be a way to test an idea, a very kind of ambitious way to test such an idea. But this is, you know, this is a constant ongoing process.
Well, and we did mention the Higgs boson earlier, and I just want to get back to that for a second, and because this is an example of physics saying, well, since this has happened, then this thing should exist. So why is the Higgs boson itself so important?
It's important because it was sort of the missing ingredient that came out of something called the Standard Model of Particle Physics. And this kind of this theory came out over decades, where people were looking at the particles that we have, and they were trying to work out where they came from, and how they're related to the forces that we have. And they came up with a framework that kind of says, okay, actually, we think we know what's going on. We think that, you know, these are the kind of forces you would expect to have between different particles. So if you have a positively charged particle and a negatively charged particle, they'll attract each other. You know, thinking about how particles are held together within atoms, within nucleuses that, you know, give rise to all the particles that make up human beings and everything we see around us. And so, they, you know, physicists had kind of put together a mathematical framework that said, okay, these are the particles we should have, these are the forces that we should have. And so, you know, the only thing they came up with was that, okay, if this is true, then we should also be able to find this thing called the Higgs boson that comes out of the part of the theory that tells us how the other particles got their mass. But, you know, where is it? And so they built this accelerator to try and find it, and they actually did find it. Now, that in itself sounds absolutely wonderful, and it is wonderful. It's this great confirmation that what physicists were thinking all those years was correct. But it also raises other questions and other problems. You mentioned earlier in the program that we don't know what something called dark energy is. That's something about why the universe is not only expanding, but its acceleration, its expansion is accelerating. It's getting faster and faster. We don't really know why. We know that there's lots of hidden matter out there, which is called dark matter. We don't really know what that is. One of the problems that we have is that this wonderful standard model of particle physics with the particles we know, the forces that we know, and the Higgs boson that we know seems to work amazingly well, but it can't explain what dark energy is. It can't explain what dark matter is. So physicists and scientists are in a very funny situation where they have a beautiful theory that works very, very well, and it seems to be corroborated by these billion-dollar experiments, and yet it's failing to explain other very important things out there about the universe. So on the one hand, it seems to be beautifully working, mathematically correct. It explains lots of things we know. It's corroborated by experiments. But on the other hand, it's kind of failing because it's not explaining all these other things.
So, a whole chunk of stuff we can't identify.
Yeah. So we're sort of even more confused in a way. If the standard model had actually failed, if we hadn't found the Higgs boson that worked very well with the standard model, we might be in sort of a somewhat better situation because we could say, oh, look, okay, so this maybe is where we're going wrong. So maybe we can now try and find dark matter and dark energy in a certain way. But we've sort of got these two kind of contradictory things where we've got something working really well, but it's not really answering some of the questions we wanted it to. So
Annette and Eugene emailed to ask if there are bangs going on all the time and we just aren't advanced enough to know it.
Oh, absolutely. That is one of the theories that, you know, at any moment in time, there could be big bangs happening all around the multiverse. And actually, some people have suggested that there could be a way we could find out about it if we're lucky. If another universe was born just outside ours, today, for instance, it might just graze our universe as it was born before kind of disappearing off, because these universes, when they're born, they kind of rush off into the distance, so we can't ever access them. But just at the moment of its birth, it might bump into ours. If it did so, it might actually leave a scar or an imprint on the sky that we could pick out, that astronomers looking for radiation in the sky could actually see. And they have been looking for such scars. They haven't found anything. They found some tantalizing hints, but they didn't actually find that evidence, but they're still looking. But, you know, it could be happening, and maybe, you know, we could find evidence of it. And I should say there's also a kind of unlucky version of this scenario as well, where a new universe could be born and could bash into ours so kind of catastrophically, it could actually destroy our universe in an instant. So perhaps I shouldn't have mentioned that to your listeners. I don't want to worry them, but, you know, that's another possibility out there.
Well, they're worried already because we have two contacts here from listeners, and I'll just lump them together. But the concern is, how do you keep a controlled universe creation in a laboratory under control? How do you keep a universe from getting as big as ours? How do you keep it in the bottle or in the small room?
Excellent question, and it was one that I was very worried about as well. So if you read the book, you'll find that I spend quite a lot of time thinking about this question, because it is a very worrying question. I mean, you don't want to accidentally create a universe in an underground laboratory that just kind of grows out like a giant inflating airbag and destroys us all. This comes very much from the calculations that the team carried out, and they showed very specifically how space and time were created in our universe and how it would be created in this new universe. And part of the process of this creation, so you'd start off with a kind of a seed particle, and it would start to inflate, but as it does so, it would actually, the process of inflating into a new universe would involve creating sort of, first of all, a wormhole between our universe and the baby universe, as we call it, our little baby, and then it would grow its own space and time in a sort of a region that was divorced from ours, and we could only access it through this wormhole. So it actually, it comes out of the mathematics, but it sort of, as it grows, it kind of inverts space and time to create its own kind of little pocket where it will grow to astronomical proportions. You know, it'll be the same size as ours or bigger, but to us, we will only see a little kind of microscopic wormhole that to us looks like a microscopic black hole in the lab. And, you know, that's what we would see from the outside. Inside, if you go through that wormhole, it's got its own space and time.
So does that space and time exist within our universe or elsewhere, and we just need to use the wormhole to get to it?
Elsewhere. So in this sort of region without space and without time, it kind of punctures a hole into that, and it grows there. It can't grow into our space and time.
Could that be the universe we were just talking about, though, that collides with another universe? I mean, how, even if we're not creating any danger to our own universe, have people thought completely out the implications of, if there is a multiverse, what the creation of a baby universe here could do elsewhere?
Oh, that's a beautiful question. I think it's not something that people have thought about, but the reason they haven't thought about it is almost in the sense of sort of saying, if this theory is correct, then so many of these universes are being born as our neighbors anyway, that, you know, almost, you know, they're already creating this kind of danger around us. And I should say it's a very, very small danger. You know, I don't want people losing sleep over the idea that we're going to be hit by a neighboring universe. But, you know, in that sense, because it is something that is already happening, I think in that sense they're not worried about creating danger to other universes.
So
I think more of the ethical questions that they've been worried about is creating suffering within that universe rather than two other existing universes.
Well, and that was the next place I was going, was if we're creating a universe that potentially has all sorts of things like our universe has in it, and then, would we just shut it off or, you know, dismember it or something when we were done with it?
Unfortunately, we don't even have that much control. So, you know, this is something that's discussed in the book. When people, you know, when physicists first started to realize that this was something they could do, first of all, they started to think, well, you know, in the way that humans often do, what can we get out of this? And so, you know, they sort of started to explore the possibility that we could jump into that universe through this wormhole or that portal. And they realized that they couldn't, because actually what happens when we see it in the lab is that it, you know, we see this tiny mini black hole, but very, very rapidly, you know, in just a very short amount of time, it would disappear. And the reason it disappears is the wormhole between them and us kind of pinches off. And at the moment that it pinches off, that universe has gone off on its own to do its own thing somewhere else. And so we can't ever kind of jump into it. So that's kind of, you know, out of the picture. We couldn't sort of mine it for resources. But we can't really prop open that wormhole even. It's just going to kind of close off naturally quite rapidly. And once it does, that universe will just grow in its own space and time, and we won't have any access to it.
So we have talked about science and religion, certainly, in the process of discussing the idea of creating baby universes. I wonder if politics is involved in this at all, if you have anyone campaigning to stop science from attempting to create baby universes, or if we're just not even that close to get to that point yet.
I think we're not. We're not at that point yet. Having said that, you know, I think scientists can take comfort, and they do take comfort. You know, I've asked them about this, and they sort of say, you know, it's many, many decades in the future. If it ever happens, you know, it might not happen. But if it does, then it's, you know, it's far down the line. We don't have to worry about it yet. Now, on the other hand, I spoke to philosophers who think very much about the ethics of these kinds of situations. And they've been thinking about the ethics of creating new life in this baby universe. And, you know, they've sort of said, well, maybe this is something, even though it might happen somewhere far down the line, maybe we should be thinking about it sooner rather than later.
You know, to make an ethical construct for it before we get to the point where physics can actually take on the task itself.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. A whole lot to think about here and a lot to learn, too, but well handled in the book, A Big Bang in a Little Room, The Quest to Create New Universes. Zia Murali wrote it and joined us today on The Exchange. Zia, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
All right. Take care.